So we'll continue with the second chapter on practices and perspectives. Mostly has been about different forms of clinging and letting go of that clinging. It continues on. Inextricably bound up with our sense of ourselves is our perception of the world outside of ourselves. Again, this is a perception that needs careful attention. As the Buddha pointed out, our experience of the world outside us is composed simply of sense impressions making contact with sense organs, not something separate from ourselves. And this is from Sangyutta 35, Sutta number 82. You also get a sense of the Buddha doing a kind of wordplay. He loves to play with language sometimes. Then a certain monk went to the Blessed One and, on arrival, having bowed down to him, sat to one side. As he was sitting there, he said to the Blessed One, "The world, the world," and the world in Pali is loka. It is said, in what respect does the word world apply? In so far as it degenerates, lucchati, monk, it is called the world. Now what disintegrates? The eye disintegrates. Forms disintegrate. Consciousness at the eye disintegrates. Contact at the eye disintegrates. And whatever there is that arises in dependence on contact at the eye, experienced as pleasure, pain, or neither pleasure nor pain, that too disintegrates. The ear disintegrates. Sounds disintegrate. And all the permutations of the contact with the ear. The nose disintegrates. Aromas disintegrate. The tongue disintegrates. Tastes disintegrate. The body disintegrates. Tactile sensations disintegrate. The intellect disintegrates. Ideas disintegrate. Consciousness at the intellect disintegrates. Contact at the intellect disintegrates. And whatever there is that arises in dependence on contact at the intellect, experience as pleasure or pain, or neither pleasure nor pain, that too disintegrates. Insofar as it disintegrates, it is called the world. Buddha just pointing to the impermanent, uncertain, ephemeral nature of the world. Because the habit of the mind is to, of course, solidify it, reify it. There's that external making of the world, and of course there's the internal reification of the sense of self. But this is talking about the external world. The next excerpt is also from Sangyutta 35. That's the Salayatana Sangyutta. It's on the section in the Sangyutta Nikaya on the sense basis. In this discourse, the Buddha gave a short instruction, then left, which wasn't understood by the bhikkhus, and then he went to his dwelling. The monks sought after Ananda and asked Ananda for clarification. And of course, as is the case oftentimes, especially Ananda, Kachana, those are monks go to for clarification to them, and they say, why are you coming to me? You should have asked the Buddha. But anyway, Ananda gave a clarification on the teaching, and then they went to the Buddha, let the Buddha know what Ananda had taught. And then the sutta ends with, Ananda is wise because Ananda has great wisdom. If you had asked me the meaning of this, I would have explained it to you in the same way. Anyway, I'll read the excerpt. Friends, when the Blessed One rose from his seat and entered his dwelling after reciting a synopsis in brief without expounding the meaning in detail, that is, bhikkhus, I say that the end of the world cannot be known, seen, or reached by traveling. Yet, bhikkhus, I also say that without reaching the end of the world, there is no making an end of suffering. I understand the detailed meaning of this synopsis as follows. That in the world by which one is a perceiver of the world, loka sanyi, a conceiver of the world, lokamani, this is called the world in the Noble One's discipline. And what, friends, is that in the world by which one is a perceiver of the world, a conceiver of the world? The I is that in the world by which one is a perceiver of the world, a conceiver of the world. The ear, the nose, the tongue, the body, the mind, is that in the world by which one is a perceiver of the world, a conceiver of the world. That in the world by which one is a perceiver of the world, a conceiver of the world, this is called the world in the Noble One's discipline. So again, the sense of recognizing that this is how we build the world. I mean, it's not, it's not a absolute sense of, oh, there is no world out there, but it's more like in reality and day-to-day experience, how do we experience the world? And it's through our contact with the senses and then our perceiving and conceiving from that. Any questions, comments? Yes.
Would you be willing to reflect a bit more about Ananda's answer defines the world, but then what the Buddha means by the end of the world?
In the same way, the end of suffering. If you're not suffering over the world doesn't exist. It just is what it is. It's a problem when you're still carrying it around. Okay, continuing on. Because our sense impressions are so dependent on our sense organs, the sense of the world out there, as opposed to ourself in here, does not accord with direct experience. When we see how this false dichotomy causes suffering, we'll drop it and be released from our attachment, both to self and to the world. And I have a quote here from Majjhima 8, which is the Salaika Sutta, the discourse on effacement. Chunda, as to those various views that arise in the world, associated either with doctrines of a self or with doctrines about the world, if the object in relation to which those views arise, which they underlie, and which they are exercised upon, is seen as it actually is with proper wisdom thus, this is not mine, this I am not, this is not myself, then the abandoning and relinquishing of those views comes about. That's a very direct realization, direct perception, and a willingness to relinquish, to let go. And the next excerpt is from Samyutta 4, Sutta number 16. Samyutta 4 is the Mara Samyutta, the Samyutta on interactions with Mara. And the Buddha is giving a teaching, and then there's a distraction as it begins. Then the Blessed One, having understood, this is Mara the Evil One, address Mara the Evil One in verse. Form, feeling, and perception, consciousness, and formations. I am not this, this isn't mine, thus one is detached from it. Though they seek him everywhere, Mara and his army do not find him. Him being one who is awakened. The one thus detached, secure, who has gone beyond all fetters. This next excerpt is back to Samyutta 35, the Sutta number 19. Bhikkhus, being stirred is a disease, being stirred is a tumor, being stirred is a dart. Therefore, bhikkhus, the Tathagata dwells unstirred with the dart removed. Therefore, bhikkhus, if a bhikkhu should wish, may I dwell unstirred with the dart removed. He should not conceive the eye, should not conceive in the eye, should not conceive from the eye, should not conceive the eye is mine. He should not conceive forms. He should not conceive eye consciousness, should not conceive eye contact, and as to whatever feeling arises with eye contact as condition, he should not conceive that, he should not conceive in that, he should not conceive from that, should not conceive this is mine. You should not conceive the ear, and then through all the sounds and all the permutations of the sense base, the nose, the tongue, the body. He should not conceive the mind, should not conceive mental phenomena, should not conceive mind consciousness, should not conceive mind contact, and as to whatever feeling arises with mind contact as condition, he should not conceive that, should not conceive in that, should not conceive from that, should not conceive that is mine. He should not conceive all, should not conceive in all, should not conceive from all, should not conceive all is mine. Since he does not conceive anything thus, he does not cling to anything in the world. Not clinging, he is not agitated. Being unagitated, he personally attains Nibbana. He understands, destroyed is birth, the holy life has been lived, what had to be done has been done, there is no more for this state of being. So it's just the mind constantly moving and proliferating with thoughts, ideas, opinions, views about the external world, me, the knower. And in one of the completely different sutta in Buddhism, one does not need to proliferate the unproliferated. Without our proliferation and our extrapolations and our conceptions, then things are as they are. And one doesn't have to make complications or difficulties or problems about it. It is as it is and can be understood, can be used skillfully, it can be relied upon for developing the path, but not to be taking a stand. Yeah?
I was wondering how to approach the concept of mara. Is there a different approach with mara? Because I can see the tendency maybe to look at it in a sense of this is parts of us that are ignorant, or it can be even seen as evil part sometimes. And I was wondering if there any guidance of how to approach this concept of mara.
Mara is actually, there's a complication. Because there's different conceptions of mara. It can be personified, you know, in the sense, okay, mara is this being who comes and tempts. And there's plenty of cases where one can see that. Also, mara is the kilesa mara, the defilements themselves inside, khanda mara, the khandas, the Machumara, as death, the ending of things. So I think a lot of it is whatever makes sense in terms of helping one to see clearly, let go, establish oneself in clarity and mindfulness. I would go for that rather than trying to pin it down exactly, okay, who is this Mara guy anyway?
And do we sort of interact with it sometimes when we feel there is that we have this willingness to walk the path and to practice, but then there is resistance, there is parts of us that are not really aligning with that goal, this aim. And when that happens, is it wise to sometimes interact?
Sometimes it's helpful. Well, it's Lopa Samedo used to talk about it a fair bit, especially dealing with doubt. The mind's doubting. The mind, what's right? What's wrong? How should I do it? And rather than trying to figure it all out, it's sort of like, I know you, Mara. And being able to cut it off before the mind starts proliferating about it. Learning to use it as a tool. And does it work or does it not work? Or how does one make it work? Because sometimes you can, be quite playful with your practice and sort of, you can dress Mara up and make him silly. So there's any number of things. So does it work? That's the main thing. Does it help? Does it help to free the mind from greed, hatred, delusion. Yeah.
What I really like about the Mara in Buddhism is that there is room for fun. Because even the way she described, it's like all this little being coming to get to see whether the Buddha is coming or not.
And yeah, yeah.
It's kind of comical, you know, it's really strange. Because
it can be, yeah, for me. Yeah, comic relief as well as karmic relief.
It's so, you know, I always associate it with the fact that the Buddha had lots of humor.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. Yeah.
Good humor.
Is conceiving a function of sankhara, is vijnana involved?
Vijnana is involved with all of it, good or bad. It's just that's a basic function of the mind. But conceiving mana is the creating in the mind of ideas that arise out of awareness, but then the mind is compelled to make an addition and conceiving of, you know, and again, is there the world outside or me inside?
So the ceasing of conceiving is the ceasing of the manas. Is sankhara related or involved in that?
Absolutely, yeah, because sankhara can be deluded as well as sankhara can be exercising wisdom. We train the mind with mindfulness and wisdom in order to learn how to let go.
So ceasing is still an act of sankhara?
It can be, in the sense when it's reflecting or turning attention in a way that there is a settling. But also, I mean, one can just attend to ceasing, because whatever thought you have is going to cease anyway. You can't sustain a thought forever. Okay. And the next one is similar. Conceiving is the theme. It is a longish quote that I have, but I thought I would read the whole sutta, which gives a kind of backstory and kind of backdrop and a tone that is kind of interesting. And it's also a bit of diversion into Buddhist cosmology. So this is Samyutta 35, sutta number 248. Bhikkhus, suppose a sheaf of barley were set down at a crossroads. Then six men would come along with flails in their hands, and they would strike that sheaf of barley with the six flails. Thus that sheaf of barley would be well struck, having been struck by the six flails. Then a seventh man would come along with a flail in his hand, and he would strike that sheaf of barley with the seventh flail. Thus that sheaf of barley would be struck even still more thoroughly, having been struck by the seventh flail. A flail is like something you beat something with. So too, bhikkhus, the uninstructed worldling is struck in the eye by agreeable and disagreeable forms, struck in the ear by agreeable and disagreeable sounds, struck in the nose by agreeable and disagreeable odors, struck in the tongue by agreeable and disagreeable tastes, struck in the body by agreeable and disagreeable tactile objects, struck in the mind by agreeable and disagreeable mental phenomena. If that uninstructed worldling sets his mind upon future renewed existence, becoming, then that senseless man is struck even still more thoroughly, just like the sheaf of barley struck by the seventh flail. Once in the past, bhikkhus, the devas and the suras were arrayed for battle. Then Vepajitti, lord of the asuras, addressed the asuras thus: good sirs, if in this impending battle the asuras win and the devas are defeated, bind Saka, lord of the devas, by his four limbs and neck, and bring him to me in the city of the asuras. And Saka, lord of the devas, addressed the Tavatinksa devas: good sirs, if in this impending battle the devas win and the asuras are defeated, bind Vepajitti, lord of the asuras, by his four limbs and neck, and bring him to me in Sudamma, the assembly hall of the devas. In that battle, the Devas won and the Asuras were defeated. Then the Tathagatang Sadevas bound away Pajitti by his four limbs and neck and brought him to Sakka in Sudamma, the assembly hall of the Devas. And there Vaipajitti, lord of the Asuras, was bound by his four limbs and neck. When it occurred to Vaipajitti, the Devas are righteous, the Asuras are unrighteous. Now right here I have gone to the city of the Devas. He then saw himself freed from the bonds around his limbs and neck, and he enjoyed himself, furnished and endowed with the five cords of divine sensual pleasure. But when it occurred to him, the Asuras are righteous and the Devas are unrighteous, now I will go there to the city of the Asuras. Then he saw himself bound by his four limbs and neck, and he was deprived of the five cords of divine sensual pleasure. So subtle, bhikkhus, was the bond of Vaipajitti, but even subtler than that is the bondage of Mara. In conceiving, one is bound by Mara. By not conceiving, one is freed from the evil one. Bhikkhus, I am is a conceiving. I am this is a conceiving. I shall be is a conceiving. I shall not be is a conceiving. I shall consist of form is a conceiving. I shall be formless is a conceiving. I shall be percipient is a conceiving. I shall be non-percipient is a conceiving. I shall be neither percipient nor non-percipient is a conceiving. Conceiving is a disease, conceiving is a tumor, conceiving is a dart. Therefore, bhikkhus, you should train yourselves thus. We will dwell with a mind devoid of conceiving. Bhikkhus, I am is a perturbation. I am this is a perturbation. Perturbation is like a disturbance. I shall be is a perturbation. I shall be neither percipient nor non, and it goes through all the permutations. I shall be neither percipient nor non-percipient is a perturbation. Perturbation is a disease. Perturbation is a tumor. Perturbation is a dart. Therefore, bhikkhus, you should train yourselves thus. We shall dwell with an imperturbable mind. Kind of like an unshakable mind. Bhikkhus, I am is a palpitation. I am this is a palpitation. I shall be is a palpitation. And it goes through all those permutations. I shall be neither percipient nor non-percipient is a palpitation. Palpitation is a disease. Palpitation is a tumor. Palpitation is a dart. Therefore, bhikkhus, you should train yourselves thus. We will dwell with a mind devoid of palpitation. So palpitation is like to be beating. Bhikkhus, I am is a proliferation. I am this is a proliferation. I shall be is a proliferation. And so on. I shall be neither percipient nor non-percipient is a proliferation. Proliferation is a disease. Proliferation is a tumor. Proliferation is a dart. Therefore, bhikkhus, you should train yourselves thus. We will dwell with a mind devoid of proliferation. Bhikkhus, I am is an involvement with conceit. I am this is an involvement with conceit. I shall be is an involvement with conceit. I shall not be is an involvement with conceit. I shall consist of form is an involvement with conceit. I shall be formless is an involvement with conceit. I shall be percipient is an involvement with conceit. I shall be non-percipient is an involvement with conceit. I shall be neither percipient nor non-percipient is an involvement with conceit. I shall be neither percipient nor non-percipient is an involvement with conceit. Involvement with conceit is a disease. Involvement with conceit is a tumor. Involvement with conceit is a dart. Therefore, bhikkhus, you should train yourselves thus. We will dwell with a mind in which conceit has been struck down. Thus should you train yourselves. The Buddha is cutting off every single avenue of proliferation. and quite beautifully, actually. And that word conceit, in English, it tends to have a connotation of lifting oneself up over others, but in Pali, mana, is just the feeling of I am, which inevitably lends itself to a sense of comparison with others. I am superior, I am equal, I am inferior, I am anything. Because what I am comes out of is just an array of arising and ceasing causes and conditions. In truth, they can all be known, but one can't create an identity or a feeling of being within that, because it's unstable. Yeah?
I've noticed previously that the Pali word for conceived is very similar to the Pali word for conceiving.
Yes.
And in the Pali canon, is conceiving always got this kind of element of I in there?
Yeah. Yeah.
Because in English, it doesn't necessarily always have, or does it? I'm not sure.
Hard to tell. Certainly with Pali, then, that with conceiving is the tendency to conceive of me, I am, but then also like a reification, a solidification of me here, but also the world out there. Yeah.
I understand the word palpitation, but I don't understand its meaning within this context.
I think movement. So that kind of movement, kind of shaky, like palpitation is if the heart is palpitating, it's going like this. The mind going like this, not so great. So it's just using language with that sense of playing with language and playing with imagery. Here is this conceiving is not stable. It's not solid. It's not dependable. Yeah.
I have two questions, therefore. The first one is, there sounds to be a very subtle distinction between perceiving and conceiving. Could you explain the subtle differences? And the second question is, since our sense of attention is so much involved in this sense of conceiving I with huh? I, how do we extricate, how do we practice in order to help us?
Well, I think that this is exactly why we pay attention to suffering. More and more, just seeing these, this is a burden, this is complicated, this is difficult, this is tiring. Do I want to keep doing this? And paying attention to what it feels like when one doesn't, because they say, oh wow, this really feels good. This is nice and bright, this is light and spacious. Just really paying attention to the feeling tone of the experience when we are in the midst of conceiving. And then, oh, what does it feel like when either we don't go there, or, oh, I can drop that.
Make that conscious.
Yeah, making it very, very conscious. And then conceiving is much more around the sense of formulating, especially with the Pali, that sense of placing oneself within the experience. With perceiving, your perception is based on memory, so that through memory we recognize things. But then also one of the aspects of perception is there's a certain meaning and value given to things. This is important, this is unimportant, this is fearful, this is safe. And of course it's bound up with memory, but it's a part of the perceiving process. And sometimes we perceive things clearly and sometimes we misperceive things. When we translate it into English, it's not so clear. In the Thai language, they don't just put one word, it's a whole sort of phrase that describes what...
Is it in Thai language?
Jam dai samkhan man mai.
That's perceiving?
That's perceiving, yeah.
Conceiving?
Conceiving, I'm not quite sure. The act of perception is relying on memory, memory banks of experience, and association, and then with that association, there is a sense of a certain value and meaning that is put. And that's, and it happens incredibly quickly.
And conceiving is like a creating. Like,
yeah, it's a creating of, especially of the thinking process. Okay.
I've often found Ajahn Suchito's translation of those two words very useful, and perceiving is like patterns, conceiving is programs.
Oh, okay.
And programs, so that's kind of a nice...
Okay, patterns and programs. Yeah. Yes?
The dissolving of I am ends up as not self. Is that right?
That's correct, yes. Yes.
And do we end up with a dissolving of this I am as at an essential level, and we still have a worldly convenient I am?
Oh, yeah, yeah. Conventionally, when somebody has really dissolved that I am, then they're really able to function without creating problems and difficulties for themselves and for others. An awakened being embodies wisdom, compassion, and purity, so that it's really living embodiments. It's not sort of some vacant ghost of a being that doesn't function. That is how we can really make a difference in the world. Okay. And then this little section, this is a short quote from the Sutta Nibbata 954, translated by Dr. Sadatisa. The wise person does not rate themselves with the distinguished, the lowest, nor with ordinary people. Calm and unselfish, they are free from possessiveness. They hold on to nothing and reject nothing. It's very simple, straightforward. And then I'm starting to wrap up this chapter. There is no distinct division between the four different forms of clinging, having clung to sensual pleasures or to views, rights, or self. Doesn't mean we are exempt from the other forms of clinging. One form of clinging can easily condition another. Similarly, unraveling one form of clinging can lead to the unraveling of others. This quote is from Majjhima 72, which is the Agyavachagota Sutta. This is a sutta to Vajagota on fire. So this is the sutta. I don't quote it, but this is the sutta where the famous image of a simile of fire going out that the Buddha used. Vajja, speculative view is something that the Tathagata has put away. For the Tathagata Vajja has seen this. Such is material form, such its origin, such its disappearance. Such is feeling, such its origin, such its disappearance. Such is perception, such its origin, such its disappearance. Such are formations, such their origin, such their disappearance. Such is consciousness, such its origin, such its disappearance. Therefore, I say, with the destruction, fading away, cessation, giving up, and relinquishing of all conceivings, all excogitations, you know, all thinking, all eye-making, mind-making, and the underlying tendency to conceit, the Tathagata is liberated through not clinging. Quite a direct equation there. Straight path. True letting go does not come about by only repeating the words of the Buddha's teachings. There needs to be an unambiguous understanding of the difficulties that ensue from grasping or clinging, and an unwavering discernment that can let go of whatever clinging leads to suffering. As explained in this next sutta, the mind that generates mental formations continues to create the causes for its entanglements, whether they are pleasant or unpleasant. With wisdom as the foundation, the mind can dwell with non-clinging as its base and realize true peace by not generating any volitional formations. This ability is not a void, empty state, resembling a vacuum. Instead, it is a dynamic state of equipoise that relies on a balance of faculties and discernment rooted in non-clinging. So this next sutta is from Samyutta 12, sutta number 51. Bhikkhus, if a person immersed in ignorance generates a meritorious volitional formation, consciousness fares on to the meritorious. If he generates a demeritorious volitional formation, consciousness fares on to the demeritorious. If he generates an imperturbable volitional formation, consciousness fares on to the imperturbable. But when a bhikkhu has abandoned ignorance and aroused true knowledge, then with the fading away of ignorance and the arising of true knowledge, he does not generate a meritorious volitional formation, or a demeritorious volitional formation, or an imperturbable volitional formation. Since he does not generate or fashion volitional formations, he does not cling to anything in the world. Not clinging is not agitated. Not being agitated, he personally attains Nibbana. He understands, destroyed is birth, the holy life has been lived, what had to be done has been done. There is no more for this state of being. In the dependent origination cycles, it begins with avijja paccaya sankhara, and when the sankhara is explained, because sankhara has so many nuances and various meanings, and it's this meritorious volitional sankhara being a volitional formation, punyabhisankhana, punyabhisankhana, nenjabhisankhana, meritorious volitional formation, demeritorious, and imperturbable, sort of steady, solid, unshaking. And then, of course, the mind which, say, true knowledge, abandon ignorance, arouse true knowledge, fading away of ignorance, arising of true knowledge. And there's no need to generate those volitional formations. One can just, and say, rest in awareness, rest in the knowing. Yes?
What does volitional formations mean?
Volitional formations is the, in Pali is sankhara, so it's a mental formation that has a volition or an intention behind it, and then generated towards something wholesome, something not wholesome, something that's actually quite bright and steady, but it's still being held by intention or volition. Okay? The next quote is from Machima 138, and that is the Udesa Vibhanga Sutta, an analysis of the statement, and it's about how to attend to outside objects without letting the mind become externally scattered, and how to focus in strong states of absorption without becoming internally positioned. Not easy, but that's the whole point of training, is that it actually can be done. The Blessed One said this, a monk should investigate in such a way that his consciousness is neither externally scattered and diffused, nor internally positioned. He would, from lack of clinging, sustenance, upadana, attachment, be unagitated. When consciousness is neither externally scattered and diffused, nor internally positioned, from lack of clinging, he would be unagitated. There is no seed for the conditions of future birth, aging, death, or stress, or suffering. Yeah?
Positioned, internally positioned, like fixated?
Or? Fixated, I think, is what it's pointing to, is that your mind is, you know really, okay, I've got to hold it. I've got to keep the mind really still. Otherwise, it's going to move. And so there's a certain fear or obsession in it. It's not sort of relaxed and just settled. It's sort of I got to keep it this way. Even the right view that induces non-clinging cannot be clung to as an end in and of itself. Although it forms a central part of the path of practice, keeping us on course and focused in the present, it has to be abandoned when it's done its work, so that true release can follow. And I wrap up the chapter with a variety of quotes, mostly from like Sutta Nipata and short verses and Dhammapada. This next one is from Sutta Nipata 839. They don't speak of purity in connection with view, learning, knowledge, precept or practice. Nor is it found by a person through lack of view, of learning, of knowledge, of precept or practice. Letting these go without grasping, at peace, independent, one wouldn't long for becoming. And the next one is from Sutta Nipata 794, 795. They don't conjure. It's like, don't imagine, don't get caught up in imagination. They don't conjure, don't yearn, don't proclaim utter purity. Untying the tied-up knot of grasping, they don't form a desire for anything at all in the world. The Brahman goes beyond territories, has nothing that, on knowing or seeing, they've grasped. Unimpassionate for passion, not impassioned for dispassion, there is nothing here that they've grasped as supreme. So these are verses that are a bit more poetic, but direct pointers, really. Those last two were translated by Dennis Robico. Next two are translated by Dr. Saritisa. Sutta Nipata 8.12, 8.13. The liberated one does not seek anything that is seen, heard, or thought. They do not seek purity through anything else, for they have neither passion nor dispassion. Next one, Sutta Nipata 5.37. And you ask about the wanderer. I'm not sure what the Pali is. Probably Samana, maybe. I'm not sure. Could be. And you ask about the wanderer, so like a religious seeker. When you see which actions hurt, and when you leave those actions and are not in those actions, or above, or below, or beyond, or between, or anywhere near those actions, then you are a wanderer. Next is from Dhammapada, verse 421, and this is Taniso's translation. One who has nothing, in front, behind, in between. The one with nothing, who clings to nothing. They're what I call a Brahman. So a Brahman is sort of like an accomplished being. This is a Dhammapada 348, also by Trinisro. Gone to the beyond of becoming, you let go in front, let go of behind, let go of between, with a heart everywhere let go, you don't come again to birth and aging. And lastly, to wrap the chapter up, as Ajahn Chah puts it very simply and succinctly, if you let go a little, you'll have a little peace. If you let go a lot, you'll have a lot of peace. If you let go completely, you will know complete peace and freedom. So that's the chapter. Any questions, comments, thoughts? Yes?
That phrase, the knot of grasping, is that upadana?
Yeah, upadana is grasping, yeah. So it's translated as attachment, clinging, sustenance is also because it attaches and trying to get something out of it. Okay, 7 o'clock.